Welcome to Contemporary Communications Conference. Let me introduce David J. Brown, who co-authored the book Mavericks of the Mind, Conversations for the New Millennium, a stimulating collection of interviews with Terrence McKenna, Robert Anton Wilson, John C. Lilly, Allen Ginsberg, among others. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
In the discarnate state, on the telephone, we have Bob Dobbs, who is Mixed Corporate Media and the author of the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Jerry. Hello, David.
Hello, Bob. Pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Let's start. Oh, please, can you start by discussing what this maverick of the mind is missing? That is Terrence McKenna.
You're asking me first.
That's right.
Well, the...
Wait, have you actually read these interviews, Bob?
Yes.
You have read the interviews. Okay.
I've seen your picture.
Okay.
On the book.
I've got your picture right here, by the way, pointing to some lint.
Yes. Very lint. All right. I'd say all of the mavericks of the mind miss the general characteristic that today, under mixed corporate media conditions, all visionary awareness, in whatever variety, is obsolete. So that would include Terrence McKenna or Allen Ginsberg or Lilly or anybody in the book.
Can I stop you there? It almost sounds like an oxymoron. I mean, how could visionary awareness be incomplete when visionary awareness is what carries us beyond the present perspective?
Well, the us is and has disappeared. The only occupants on the global theater are the mixed corporate media, and that's our problem.
Okay.
So I'm talking about public communication. I think that the mixed corporate media give everybody personal visionary hyper-subjectivity experiences to the max for the last 20, 30 years. But that leaves everybody in their own little solipsistic bubble.
Right.
So we've got to create a language in Esperanto that creates or retrieves some kind of public space or public language that we can share that could communicate something that is beyond our grasp. And I think that's when people get into expressing their own particular enlightenment, that is a cliche today, just as creativity on a personal level is a cliche. And my problem that I feel that I solved is how to express the collective consciousness we are now in. So that's what I mean by saying visionary awareness is obsolete. It's on the personal level. And when it's obsolete, that means it's a cliche. We all have it and have it in varying degrees of intensity going up the wave or down. But in terms of communicating to other people, if they've disappeared and are not listening or having their own experiences, what common ground do we have?
Maybe I'm not sure what you mean by visionary experience then, or visionary perspective.
Right. Well, you say what you think it is, and then I'll respond.
Well, to me, a visionary perspective means seeing beyond the ordinary, seeing beyond the limited, seeing beyond whatever particular perspective we're stuck in. It's looking one step beyond. It's what's coming up over the horizon. So, I mean, it'll vary from person to person, obviously, because everybody's on different points on a continuum in terms of their evolution or their development or as a individual, as a species, or as a culture, or whatever. But I mean, I'm not sure I understand how that could ever be something obsolete, no matter what point on the continuum of development you are, because you're always going to be looking towards the horizon for something new to evolve into.
Yeah, now personally, in your own body, you can look at the horizon. But in terms of the media we have, there is no horizon. There is a tactile space that's resonating and pulsating, and it has visual characteristics, but they are minor in relation to the acoustic, kinetic, proprioceptive, and tactile characteristics. So we have to determine what sense we're talking in, because the bias implied in the word visionary is the eye.
Right, yeah.
And so I don't think that the eye vision and the horizon, as a matter of fact, I go so far to say that ESP is obsolete when effects precede causes. When we have new environments coming upon us, the effects of them show up before we have the actual technology that institutes those effects.
Does they move backwards through time?
No, there's not even time. They're just environments, and they have characteristics. And traditionally, the artist of cultures, the visionary in the old sense, would pick up these effects and express them. The most amazing and long-lasting visionary expression of this would be Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, where he picked up the effects of all technologies that came since his time, including CD-ROM and virtual reality, and express the effects on perception beyond his own personal point of view about them.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually looking over the horizon involves ESP or some kind of precognition, but I think that the human mind can't see the effects in the old ESP techniques as effective as he uses these new techniques, which I advocate, which are studying the effects of the environments before they arrive. So if you read in my liner notes, I talk about the hologram phase is from 1977 to 1990. That the hologram is here is a small technology that maybe laboratories have and certain little gadgets, but it is not here as an environment. But the effects of it that it's going to have when it becomes an environment are already here. And those effects were manifested all across the world culture from 77 to 90.
And those effects being, I'm assuming you mean the condensing of information into from everywhere into every specific point?
Right, and also the idea of virtual reality or living inside an environment that is a simulation. That sense of a hologram, too.
Okay, I've heard you talk before about how you think that we're reincarnating the Akashic Records or something like that in a electronic environment, and that we're becoming disincarnate in electronic space.
Yeah, that point about the Akashic Records is perfect to what I'm talking about. Theosophists talk about the Akashic Records, and maybe other mystics, and maybe Blavatsky got it from the Oriental mystics and the Great White Brotherhood or whatever. I would say that the movie medium, it contains all times and spaces. So we externalize the idea of the Akashic Records, which includes all times and spaces, in the movie medium. So the effects of the Akashic Record were here as we built up the movie environment. We're beyond the Akashic Records in the TV environment, because when you look at the screen of the television, it's a resonating mosaic of intervals, and you are the screen, and you're forced to create an image out of the mosaic.
Mm-hmm.
You're creating something, and you're doing that every day. I think this goes beyond the idea of a container called the Akashic Records, which has all times and spaces. I think we're, in general terms, hallucinating collectively beyond the metaphor of the Akashic Records. So that's an example of an ESP model, the Akashic Records, being obsolete.
Okay, I'm not sure when you say hallucinating, I'm not sure what you mean by that.
I mean that the eye, the ear, and the hand is projecting onto the environment rather than receiving impressions passively, which is characteristic of life from 1500 to about 1900.
Okay, but that sounds like an interactive, co-creative process. I mean, hallucination implies seeing something that's not there.
Right. Well, I begin with that. Now you're being more precise. Yes, hallucination and dreams come from the movie environment. It's fantasy that comes out of the television environment.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a co-creative thing. Yes, but it's a hallucination in the sense that what you were seeing may have a hard reference point or may have a lack of reference point for anybody else who's projecting. Establishing a reference point is hard to do as viewers experience a TV environment. So from one person's point of view to the other, or one culture's point of view to the other, they're hallucinating in relation to them. They don't see the same thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not sure I understand why film and television are so different in terms of, you say one affects dreams and one affects fantasy, and I'm not sure I understand the distinction.
Yeah, movies simulate dreams in the sense that they take you on a trip, usually an outer trip, because an extension of the eye and the foot,
mm-hmm,
float into an environment. And also, you are in the seat, in the theater. This is before VCRs and that.
Right.
But originally, the movie experience was a solitary experience in like Plato's cave. Now, television comes along, and you have millions of people watching the same content at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That's different in terms of simultaneity. In the movie environment in the 30s, maybe people saw a movie over a two-month period. Many millions of people saw it, but they saw it in smaller groups and not as instantaneous.
Right. So you're saying there's a non-local phenomenon, like it's happening everywhere at once, and everybody's having the same experience all at once in many different points in space.
And also it's live. That's a big different thing. I mean, the movie is a package. It's like,
mm-hmm,
a book. And it's not live in the sense that TV is live. And it's very interesting that the powers that be sort of stopped live TV in the mid-60s for 12 years or 10 years until Saturday Night Live came back. But I think they felt... And I knew about this in the Secret Council 10, is that they felt the live experience of TV was not controllable. So the movie environment creates an environment that Hitlers and dictators in the Stalin or Churchill or Roosevelt mode and Mussolini mode can control the environment. But once we got into live TV, That was a new situation, which left a lot of the traditional radio era establishment looking fragile. So you see the basic point. TV is a totally different environment on the technical level compared to movies.
And in the sense that it's instantaneous, in the sense that people have a choice, in the sense that it's non-local. So, I mean, so the distinction you're making between television and films carries over into the distinction between dreams and fantasies, where you're saying then that a dream is something prepackaged,
yes,
and a fantasy is interactive, you're co-creative, you're helping to develop the fantasy.
Yeah, that's good.
Of course, that doesn't apply really to lucid dreams, though, where one is actually interactive within the dream, though.
Well, think of the title Finnegan's Wake.
That's a lucid dream, the idea of being lucid in a dream, then.
Well, we are, collectively, that's the thing about television, you are lucid dreaming. Marshall McLuhan used to talk about, with TV, we are dreaming awake.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, movies are dreaming, then movies become content of television. So we're gone beyond the movie environment. And if movie was dream, then we're into a new situation, which he called dreaming awake, which you could call lucid dreaming.
Right, right.
That experience has not been communicated properly or articulated, so then we have confusion. So the population is lucid dreaming and not knowing it, and therefore in a state of confusion. But once they hear the statement of what is going on, then they could realize they're lucid dreaming, and then they're really Finnegan's awake.
Okay, I see. So you're saying that the evolution then is from a point of passivity, prepackaged receptivity, to,
yeah,
something interactive, co-creative, where people have a ability to you know, give and take and have and co-create with whatever,
yeah,
develops. Yeah.
The room, you know, yeah, when you're watching TV, you can turn the sound off, and also there's another point there. The common cliche about TV in the 50s and 60s was that it was a passive medium. You just sat there and received impressions.
Yeah.
They didn't understand technically that when your eye and ear is looking at the mosaic mesh of the TV screen, the cathode ray coming at you, that all that's there is like a pointillist Surratt's painting. You know, pointillism and
Surratt? Sure, sure, yeah.
There's these dots. And your perceptors, your receivers, are making an image out of it. There's an image being transmitted, but your brain has to find that image and carve it out, mm-hmm, of the dots.
Sure, yeah, it's like
an active, and that created the, to get into Terence McKenna, that created the massive acceptance, subconsciously, of the LSD kind of experience, where you turned your senses into makers and sculptors of space.
It also made people aware of the digital nature of reality.
Yeah.
Right, so everything is composed of little bits and bytes that can be rearranged.
That's right, so because we were getting that collectively on the unconscious, we then could do it privately, and the acceptance of drugs happened in the 60s.
So you see the acceptance of psychedelics specifically, I assume you mean, like LSD or psilocybin, you see as being related to, I mean, it took prior having developed a certain technological medium like television before people would accept it on a mass level.
Yes, because if you took people in the 30s and 20s and gave them LSD, I think that there would be even worse confusion and maybe trauma, because people would not have had that kind of collective experience through the medium of TV first, and it would have been more traumatic.
But how do you explain the fact then that, you know, that people have been taking psychedelics long before the advent of any real high technology? I mean, it's been in the tribal societies for thousands of years since the beginning. I mean, Terence McKenna documents how, you know, I mean, it's been before there were any real signs of civilization, the first tribes used.
Well, that gets into my knowledge. The archaic revival that he talks about is a symptom of the fact that we've retrieved with television the Paleolithic, pre-Paleolithic, however, the most primitive awareness has been retrieved by the television environment. So, yes, different cultures took it. It's interesting when you bring in the phonetic alphabet and then the printing press that you see the suppression of this kind of activity, or in general. I mean, there always were individuals, for whatever reason, taking drugs through history.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking on public archetypes and collective archetypes. In general, it was considered, witchcraft or wasn't even considered in, say, the last 1,000 years in Western society. Because
mm-hmm.
the suppression of the other senses by the dominance of the visual sense allowed people to get into a passive mode in general, and therefore as a society did not look upon cultures that they came in contact with that did this kind of stuff as something equal to them. They felt they were barbarian or inferior or just strange and weird. But when the main point of my knowledge is that when we get into the electric age, we then start to retrieve primitive awareness.
It brings back, like Marshall McLuhan talked about, how it brings back a sort of tribal awareness television.
Yes, and he talked about it in mm-hmm. terms of bringing back occult awareness and primitive awareness and drug taking. He talks about that, and Terence McKenna picked up on it, and you can look about late 80s, early 90s, he wrote a review of the letters of Marshall McLuhan, And myself, knowing Marshall and knowing McKenna's work, I found it very interesting that McKenna was kind of obsessed the way McLuhan predicted that computers, when it became an environment, he told Tim Leary, when it became an environment, which happened in the 70s, especially on the personal level, that then there would be great interest in drug taking. Now, that sentence, McKenna points out from the letters of McLuhan, and he finds it curious, and he's intrigued by it, and he also is intrigued in the relationship between Burroughs and McLuhan. So McKenna has read enough of McLuhan to see that there's something what McLuhan's saying that he is trying to approximate, but I don't think he has a big enough understanding of the archetypes of evolution that we've developed, that Marshall developed, taken from Finnegan's Wake, so that it's not a mystery for McKenna. I think he's still wrestling with it, and I hear it in his lectures on language. He's usually talking about verbal language when he talks language.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't talk about the new languages, which are the environments that we've created.
The new languages are the... Can you expand on that? I'm not sure what you mean by that.
There's the environment created by speech.
You mean like a post-symbolic language that's created just visually?
No, Marshall used the term language for all our technologies and the environment they create. So the printing press, the Gutenberg Galaxy, he called it, was a new language with a visual bias that altered the old language of speech and body movement, the kinetic language, and other languages of the senses. And then when the electric age came in, we retrieved the acoustic and tactile senses in the new language of electricity and the environment.
Right.
So the electric environment and the print environment are new languages as opposed to the old speech language. All media, all these means of human expression are languages. So there's different types of language.
Okay, I make a distinction between language and medium. I mean, I'm not sure I understand.
Yeah, that's where Marshall disagrees with you. To understand Marshall's sort of definitions and suggestions, you need to know that any artifact created by humans is a language because it creates an environment, and it's a shared environment among people and the users and the culture that use that artifact.
And by so doing, it carries a message.
That's right.
That's what you're saying. You know, I interviewed Jaron Lanier recently, the virtual reality pioneer, who spoke to me about how he believes in virtual reality will have a post-symbolic language where you won't use words or symbols, but rather describe experiences just by creating them visually and experientially. So, you know, if I want to describe to you what it's like to go to New York, I'll create the experience of you being in New York.
And how will you communicate it? Through a virtual reality disc or something that you put on?
Well, while you're in virtual reality, he will then create the experience for you.
Right. Now, that's exactly what I mean. That's already the effects of that are what I mean in my chart. That hologram, which is like virtual reality, he will create environments for you.
Exactly, yeah. And
that's like a hologram environment you're living in. And so he calls it post-symbolic. All media, all languages are symbolic and metaphors of our bodies. They come from our parts of our body and our metaphors for them. So it's inaccurate to say something's post-symbolic because I know he means literate and verbal symbolism.
Right. Yeah.
But if you know that all media are symbolic, then you might be more particular in how you would say that.
Mm-hmm.
But what he's saying is a technical application and the technical invention of the ability to do that. And of course people will use it and they communicate like that, but he's missing the point that the effects of that have already happened over the last 15 years.
Uh-huh.
Collective unconscious. Ronald Reagan was a fine example, as Baudrillard says, of a mirage, a virtual reality president.
Because of his ambiguity?
Yes, ambiguity is really important. Yeah, he was post-verbal.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie Mason does a great skit on Ronald Reagan, why he was more successful than Carter. Carter went around the late 70s in anguish about all the problems. All Reagan did was laugh about them and dismiss them. So he didn't get involved in verbal explanations and dueling with the issue at hand. He just used, I would say, phatic community. He waved, he talked, he used body language. He just kind of expressed a general indifference. And that was more successful in a virtual reality situation, the effects having arrived in our subconscious, than the anguish of a Carter.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And Mason, he doesn't talk about it the way I'm doing, but I'm saying Jackie Mason, as an artist, picks this up and does great skits on it. Check out his album from a few years ago where he talks about Contragate in that.
Hmm, okay. So some of the other mavericks I interviewed in my book, maybe you can point out what you feel that they're missing?
Yeah, in reference to, I would just say that Terence McKenna is probably aware that that Marshall knew there was an archaic revival, but I think that Terence, either ideologically or in a propaganda sense, puts in great value in the fact it's an archaic revival, and we've already had it in a lot of ways. He sort of specializes into the revival of drug taking or natural psychedelics, mm-hmm. so that because he's focusing on that particular historical culture, that part of our legacy,
right.
he is allowing especially younger people to focus on something, and they need to focus on something in terms of knowledge, culture-specific, because it's very hard to see the mixed corporate media and how it's interacting until you sort of have experience for like 20, 30 years in, mm-hmm. in the media environment. So he provides an antidote, an ersatz anti-environment for people, but it is puny and minuscule in expressing the nature of the present we live in right now, which has services and disservices. And the archaic revival is a service and disservice for different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So he's talking about the figure and missing the ground of the effects of the archaic revival and all these different cultures throughout the planet, which are in different stages of technological evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You see, when you think of that term, McKenna is puny, and every one of the Mavericks are puny.
Hmm.
But that's what I would say. In particular, I take issue with the term archaic revival. And McKenna, now you can mention some others.
Okay, well, let's try somebody else. I mean, how about Tim Leary?
Well, Tim Leary, I see...
Well, who was one of the first, I mean, really, you know, right after Marshall McLuhan, one of the first people to talk about the relevance of, you know, living in an electronic environment. He's one of the first people to really start talking along those lines.
Yeah, now that's where he talks a lot about Marshall McLuhan. I've spoken to him, and I asked him, why did you start talking about Marshall McLuhan in the last few years when you didn't talk about him since the 60s?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I didn't understand fully what Marshall did. And then I said, is it because the Berlin Wall went down that you are now have a rekindled interest in the global village idea of Marshall McLuhan? He says, yeah, it was since the wall went down, I saw in some sense that the global village was here. So I said, well, do you know that Marshall's main insight was not the global village, which was already articulated by Wyndham Lewis and Buckminster Fuller and maybe even Edward Hall?
Mm-hmm.
Some people attribute it to Buckminster Fuller. Other people attribute it to Wyndham Lewis. And Marshall knew Wyndham Lewis, so he probably got it from Wyndham Lewis. What Marshall saw was the global theater, which was the fact that global village, which in electrical terms existed since the telegraph, the radio, telephone environment.
In a limited, more limited way, yeah, right.
Oh, technically we had all moved into the same discarnate resonating spot, but I'll explain that a little later if necessary.
Okay.
What happened is that when the planet extended itself via the satellite, which is a man-made environment that simulates the planet. A person can live inside a satellite, a space capsule, just like you can live on the planet. So we've extended the whole planet as a living environment. Now, when the ring of satellites starting with Sputnik in 57 went around the planet, it turned the planet into a theater. It turned the radio and telegraph and telephonic and TV environment, the global village, into a global theater.
Right.
It had a proscenium arch around it. And that is what he emphasized all through the 60s and 70s, and nobody picked up on it. And so here's Tim Leary seeing, oh, the global village is sort of basically a political fact. And so he's just catching up to the 1930s. And he doesn't understand Marshall enough to understand the relevance of the global theater notion and what that's doing to all different cultures around the planet, which are at different stages of development.
And what is it doing exactly?
Well, you take when the satellite, think of the satellite in 57. By
62,
when Telstar went up, then you had a more popular awareness of the satellite environment. You had the song Telstar.
Mm-hmm.
And the satellites really started to ring the planet put up by the Soviet Union and the United States. You then see what happened in different cultures in the 60s. All may be interpreted on a journalistic level as due to new improved communication, television, radio, whatever people sort of saw as a figure,
mm-hmm.
not noticing the ground of satellites. So you had turmoil in every society. In China, you had... Now, here's what a new environment does. It erases the image of the culture, which is based on previous technology. Therefore, the culture has to strive to create a new image, a new identity, in relation to the effects of the new environment, or retrieve an old image through violence. Both
right.
processes are violent, but to retrieve an old image is pretty hard compared to dealing with the new image, and to find a new image, which you don't know what it is, or how to find it, or what to base it on, since you're operating in response to a satellite environment that's largely invisible on you. So you have violence in all societies. So in China, all of a sudden they decided to have Mao's revolution, the children's crusade, where they allowed young people to wipe out the whole middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Okay, that's China. Then in the United States, it's well known what happened in the United States and in the West, the student uprisings.
Right.
And the whole sensory upheaval in general of all kinds of cultural institutions in the West. I would say that later in the, say by the early 70s, the third world countries, the Arabian countries, the Aboriginal countries in Australia, started to have a sense of their own tribal identity, and you had all kinds of separatisms breaking out.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the effect gets to Iran, you have fundamentalism comes in. So you have a lot of tribal retrievals or tribal upheaval going on in cultures all around the world from 62 to 82, say,
mm-hmm.
all due to the unconscious effect of the satellite environment, where the culture feels inadequate, and it is in relation to the satellite effect,
mm-hmm.
tries to retrieve an old image or forge a new image, and at the same time is mad at the industrial image, which was the, say, movie, steel, television, we'll call it the Western environment, cultural imperialism, whatever you want to call that Western industrial environment that was running the world up to the 60s. All these cultures certainly saw the inadequacy of that model because it was not on the par of the communicating effect of the satellite environment. So then all these cultures are angry and want to separate from the industrial West, yet they're trying to find a new ground for their culture inside a satellite environment, which affects the money environment to the point that money is moved around the planet, which creates inflation. It's moved so fast, and that mm-hmm. is, that's including the computer environment, that all cultures and all nations in the world suffered inflation in the 70s. And that was due to the combination of the computer and the satellite.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm just giving you an example of some of the services and disservices, mainly
right.
services. And that kind of stuff that Marshall wrote about, especially in his book Take Today, The Executive's Dropout,
mm-hmm.
has never been dealt with. And when Tim Leary comes out with this new video, you know, celebrating the wisdom of Marshall McLuhan, and just is dealing with the global village, that's such an inadequate understanding and using McLuhan in an inadequate way. You're not promoting what he really talked about. So that is, and Tim Leary, he actually has a copy of Take Today in his house. I was in his house a while back.
Yeah.
And I had asked him if he, before I got there, if he had a copy of Take Today. He says, no, I don't know that book. Well, a few weeks, months later, I was in his house, and he was getting dressed, and I was waiting for him, so I was looking at his library. There he has a copy of Take Today. You pull it out, and it is autographed by Mrs. McLuhan about 1988.
Uh-huh.
Got it from Mrs. McLuhan in 88. However he interacted with her at that point, I don't know. And there it is, a copy of the book autographed to him. He didn't even know he had it. So he obviously never read it, and for some reason didn't want to read it. And so I caught him, you know, guilty of having a book he didn't know he had.
Oh, I've caught Timothy guilty of not knowing a lot of things that he has. So it's not that surprising.
Yeah, I think it's due to age. He's a little, amnesiac?
Amnesiac? Well, he's maybe a little senile is the word. Suffering from some memory disorder problems, yeah.
Yeah, I think he's not. Yeah, his memory, he may not have a fully functioning memory of all that he experiences.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So the
You're saying that this desire to go back or to use an old model or an old metaphor or an old perspective is because when a new perspective, the present model isn't working with all the data, so we look backwards for something or we look
forward.
Or we look forwards.
Forward.
When we look backwards and we gain an old model, do we try to expand it in some way?
Yeah, we retrieve it as an archetype. It's actually an old archetype. We bring it back and use it in a new way. We alter it a bit and to use it and try to institute it. And usually that works for a while, but then the environment changes again, so that cliche becomes an old archetype and scrapped again.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's a retrieval process going on all the time. William Butler Yeats wrote about it in the poem called The Circus Animal Desertion, where he talked about when he had exhausted his creative abilities, he would go back down and lay in the rag and bone shop of the heart, find some old garbage cans, which he meant as symbols for cliches, and then climb back up the ladder to create a new archetype.
Uh-huh, I see.
So this creative process yeah. is always going back and looking for scrapped images, scrapped environments, and bringing them back, if they are relevant to the new situation. So obviously Terence McKenna's metaphor, and I consider McKenna a holopathic retrieval, not just of Tim Leary, but of Leary and Gary Snyder.
What we say holopathic. I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
If you read my chart from after the hologram phase from 1977 to 1990,
right.
get into what I call the holopathic retrieval phase, which is we've gone beyond the effects of the hologram. We've now completely disappeared all media, so that we live in a sort of a place where...
You mean like a non-local space, where everything,
right.
Everything everywhere is present everywhere.
Yeah, and you have a holeopathic is a combination of hologram and homeopathy. And you know how in homeopathy, the more diluted, the tinier the substance, the more effective it is?
Exactly, right.
So we have what I call retrievals of the hologrammic phase made tiny, like homeopathy. So they're holeopathic, and they're retrievals. So you have retrievals all across the Western culture and most of the world since 1990. Examples are Rush Limbaugh. I consider Terrence McKenna a holeopathic retrieval. Bill Clinton is of the Democratic Party. Neil Paglia is of feminism. And you have these different aberrations, and they're holeopathic because whole cultural archetypes are focused into one person.
Huh.
And that person represents a whole cultural baggage.
Huh.
And even to the point they claim they are the source of that. And that's what Camille Paglia says. She was really the original feminist pre-Steinem and Frieden. So the holeopathic retrieval is what Terrence McKenna is in the psychedelic counterculture. And he's a combination of Leary and Snyder. Who, Snyder and Leary, were at opposite ends of the polls. I think that Snyder had the more naturalistic view and go for the artificial chemicals that Leary did.
Right.
But, and Terrence takes that view of Snyder's. But I think as a proselytizer, he comes across as a Tim Leary.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a media image of Tim Leary he retrieves. But the actual content of his propaganda is Gary Snyder's view.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious then, what role do you think psychedelics are going to be playing then in the future?
Well, I think they will be used constantly in every generation as long as we live in this electric environment, because the what happens is that kids grow up in the TV and computer environment.
Right.
And they are being stimulated like a psychedelic on the whole group, on the whole age group. And individually, their senses are being stimulated. So they're living in a psychedelic environment already since when they're born. Now, usually when in the late teens, they've absorbed so much TV that they've reached a saturation point, and you'll find that maybe there is a drop-off of TV consumption once kids leave the house or go to college or work, and they move out of the family.
Right.
Now, you could say economically they can't afford a TV, but that's not really true because TV is everywhere. Now, what happens when they move away from that cocoon of suburbia where they've been bombarded by television for 15 to 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then might go into drug taking. Now, what they don't realize is they actually still need, subconsciously, the stimulation that the TV environment gave them. So they get it privately through drugs. So as long as we have the television environment, you will always have every generation taking drugs to meet that felt need for inner tripping. So we are guaranteed by it forever, and that's why Tim Leary can go around to college campuses right now. I mean, for someone like me who has a lot more detailed and intricate knowledge than Tim Leary, and maybe another person like Henry Kissinger, and I don't mean this as a value judgment, but he might have a lot of different knowledge about what it's like to run a very complex society. But the young people go for someone like Tim Leary because that he's an archetype, or that psychedelic need that people have, that inner tripping need, and so his blandishments and bland pronouncements are meet a felt need on a certain age group for every generation.
Mm-hmm.
And Terrence McKenna probably will feel that need when Leary's gone. Will fill that need.
That need, right? For
it's only for, you could say, discarnate children in their 20s, late teens, early 20s. They will move out of that as they get more, as they have more experiences. However, they get it, they will then develop their sensory abilities and their flexibility of their talents and skills, and will not be so focused on that need for inner tripping. They'll do it other ways, just by being obsessive about your work is a form of inner tripping. So that I think it's a passing fancy and a passing fanny for generations to go through Leary, and they will go on to something else. But there's always the next class coming up.
Mm-hmm. But back to the idea of psychedelics in general. I mean, you see them basically as just an extension of television, which was just satisfying that need for inner tripping, as you say. And I mean, there's a real distinction though, between something like television that is flashing all these superficial messages at you, and something like LSD that puts you in touch with parts of yourself that you haven't been conscious of.
That's true. Now remember, I'm not talking about private experience. When you take LSD, you are being stimulated in a way that's quite traumatic or quite exciting. Whatever happens, it's quite revelatory.
Yeah.
But now I'm talking about public archetypes, collective archetypes. And when you have, when I'm talking about television, I'm talking about the effect of that on millions of people, on millions of young people.
Mm-hmm.
For those millions of young people actually can't be individuals and make a choice whether they're going to take drugs or not. In general, they'll want to take them for a while because of the general effect. But I'm not talking about the, what I call the private citadel of consciousness, your particular need, your particular brain, and what you want, because you'll have all kinds of experiences that are meaningful to you. But you're dealing with an environment that requires language to be communicated, and television is a new language having effects on us that relate to the other older languages, movies, newspaper, radio, bulldozers, skyscrapers, to speech and books.
Right.
So I'm talking, of course, television doesn't seem to do to me what cocaine or heroin does, all right? But it is doing to me in terms of its effects on the whole society, which I have to deal with as a private individual.
Uh-huh.
Because you have to grow up in a world that the computerized environment has evaporated all kinds of old hardware job tasks for you. That is something that's happened to your to our time for young people. They're moving into an environment that seems to have not as many employment opportunities in the traditional way. Despite how many times they take drugs or get insights from a Zen Buddhist, they have to deal with that collective fact of our time.
Right.
That is the general. As T.S. Eliot said, I cannot talk in the particular. I can only talk in the general. If I talk in the particular, then I'm imposing my views on you, and then we have to negotiate that. But we both have, we both speak, and we both deal with these new environments, and we can learn to talk about them beyond our personal experience and point of view.
So as to help avoid biases, you mean?
Yeah, personal biases.
Right, and right.
That's what the whole crisis in North American or American culture is, between the right, the left, and that. Everybody's projecting their own personal fantasies or desires or lifestyles onto the public screen, not knowing that the public screen is not a central point that's like a switchboard that's going to tabulate your thing and then tabulate some proof of what this did in certain evidence against what the other group wants. These things constantly cancel each other out.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't expect to project your lifestyle or your desires without getting a reaction. And also in that confusion, every social group, every tribe, has to get identity only through violence. And you assert your identity by demanding recognition or imposition of your desires on the public's general space.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all within a discarnate environment, which is very hard to talk about. So that's why you have endless talk shows and content argument over issues that project people's personal bias, and they're missing the environment and language that they're operating in that unites them more than they ever realized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the cure for this is what? What do you think?
The cure?
Yeah.
Well, me.
You know, I thought I saw a video where you got shot.
I don't look like that. That guy is my father.
Your father. I'm curious, Bob. What do you think happens to consciousness after death, then?
Well, I know what happens after you die.
Please enlighten us.
I've actually played tapes of that on my radio show in Toronto.
You've been able to record what the after-death process, you mean?
Yes. Well, I had had spirit describe what happens to you, and not only what happens to you, but what happens to different cultures. Because your cultural conditioning determines how you have a death experience.
Oh, so you think basically that a person's belief system influences what they experience after they die.
Oh, that's right, definitely.
Just like it influences what happens while we're alive.
Yes.
So that a Buddhist has a nirvanic experience, a Christian has a heaven or hell experience, and on and on and on.
Yeah, there's in general terms of that way, but even the Tibetan Book of the Dead, like people like William Irwin Thompson and people who have been interested in Oriental Buddhism think that they've got a monopoly on understanding the stages of death and what happens to you after you die.
Right.
And they have the edge over the West in terms that they assert that you live after you die. So if you don't believe there's life after death, then you're limited. But in the realm of describing what's happening after you die, the Tibetan Buddhists are as biased as anybody else can be. And that's not understood today. Most people are just amazed that they seem to understand the post-death experience and seem to tell you the stages. But those stages are culture and condition. And I wouldn't, I would say, do not expect those stages to happen to you when you die. So do not rely on the Tibetan Book of the Dead or the Egyptian Book of the Dead or any new books that come out from any culture that tells you the stages. You have to realize what culture you're from. Then we're also in a new acultural situation, a culture that has no reference point. This new discarnate, unlocalized situation we're in is having effects on our brain, and that will alter the death experience because it is a new active culture on us, even though we don't have very good language to talk about it.
Hmm.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah. So do you see a possibility then for us to be able to, say, extract the personality pattern information out of your brain and download it into a purely electronic environment, become completely discarnate, where you will not even have a physical body anymore, and you'll exist primarily in a cyberspace virtual reality kind of field or something like that?
Yeah, Hans Moravec talks about that.
Yeah, right.
And there's a good interview with him in the new Mondo 2000. It's been out for a few months now.
Right, right. The fellow who wrote the book Mind Children, right? Robotics?
Yes.
Person at Carnegie Mellon, I believe?
Yes.
Right.
Okay, he's projecting that can happen, and I imagine it will happen. And that's an expression of the confusion that's going to happen, where if minds, or whatever we call the private state of the consciousness, that can be preserved in a computer lattice while the body is dropped off or repaired.
Right.
What is that thing versus the electric environment? Or what is it as opposed to the computer lattice it's inside of? You mean humanity has always had the problem of what the mind is and what the culture and language is. As Milton expressed in Paradise Lost, when the devil or Beelzebub fell, the problem that created that fall was he confused his mind with language.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bucky Fuller used to talk about the difference between brain and mind. Now, mind seems to be, from the Oriental point of view, that eternal consciousness, what I call the private sizzle of consciousness, just that thing that's just there, and we don't even know the boundaries of that. We might all be that one thing.
Right.
That is not affected by anything and lives forever. And that forever maybe just be one moment. You know what I mean? It's our living in the body that makes us think it's a sequence of time that is not one moment, but a series of moments that has an end. So what is that thing that's eternal? When does it become electricity?
Mm-hmm.
And then physical body? And if we can start manipulating and creating electrical levels and the astral levels and the physical body with what, nanotechnology?
Yeah.
They call it evolutionary engineering as opposed to genetic engineering. We are then really playing with this dilemma of where does the mind leave off and where does the physical vibration begin?
Right.
Whatever subtly that vibration is. But I think it always will be an eternal problem where you're aware of yourself as having mindfulness, but you're also experiencing something where you may be separate from other people or in a different resonance with them.
Mm-hmm.
But we have flipped the astral plane. William Irwin Thompson talks about this a lot, that we are altering the astral plane when we can bring and influence the mind so it doesn't die. That'll affect the traditional structures that one does die into before in the past, before we got into this situation where scientists can actually hijack the astral plane and preserve you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to confuse the death process, maybe. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think the real question then comes is, let's say we could extract information out of someone's brain, and we're extracting what the basic components of their mind are, and we download them into a computer, and we have this vast array of memes and belief systems and whatever. The question is it conscious, and how would you know if it is or isn't?
That's right. You're like, what is consciousness? That has never been answered, that question. And that's where media become models for cultures as conscious. And then they are metaphors for the private consciousness.
Well, as far as I know, besides the Turing test, which we know is completely fallible, there's no way to determine whether something or somebody is actually conscious besides yourself.
Right. And so, while we're living in this world, that's where we begin to look at the medium. We say, well, if you take a visually biased society, then they will be detached from the sensory matrix. Before you bring in the phonetic alphabet and in the printing press,
yep,
the visual sense operates in harmony with the other senses. And so that's what we admire about preliterate cultures, tribal cultures, who have not been abstracted visually.
Mm-hmm.
Once you, in the West, its genius was to abstract the visual sense due to the meaningless bits and sounds of the phonemic alphabet, the phonetic alphabet made up of phonemes.
Right.
The phoneme was an abstract, meaningless bit that did not relate to the sensory matrix or what your senses saw as ideograms did.
Right.
Chinese. They would show physical reality in the language. So when we got into this abstract process, isolating the visual sense out of the other sensory matrix, and the visual sense is the only one that can be isolated, then you had a separation between the culture and nature, which we've called in the 20th century the Western hang-up. It doesn't appreciate the interaction with nature.
Right.
That's the disservice of the visually biased society. So,
Bob, hold on for 1 second. I'd like to remind our listeners we're talking with David J. Brown and Bob Dobbs, and we'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Contemporary Communications Conference. We're talking with David J. Brown, who co-authored the book Mavericks of the Mind, and Bob Dobbs, who is a mixed corporate media and the author of the book Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, David, I was saying in response to the point about we don't know what is animate or inanimate.
Yeah.
And I was trying to say, well, since we personally, on a private little conscious level, find it hard to know anything in reference to our hidden center of consciousness, then we have to look at cultures and language, since language is what people share. So I was explaining how the West developed a visual biased view of nature, a view of reality, where they isolate the visual sense through the phonetic alphabet and then the printing press,
right,
to the matrix of all the other senses, therefore detaching themselves from the flow of nature and all the senses, and therefore from nature in general. And it was only the Western society that created the category of nature, capital N nature, which was a result of writing, and in particular phonetic alphabet. And they started to study the content of nature because they were abstracted from it. They didn't realize that was the effect of phonetic alphabet and later the printing press. But therefore it led to, especially from the 1500s on, where the visual bias was intensified greatly and more than the phonetic alphabet due to the printing press and the mass distribution of printed books, that then you had the development of science, which did not have an interest in, say, transparency of nature or nature as an occult phenomenon and all the different experiences that are labeled under magic. It moved away from magic. Then when the 20th century brought back the acoustic space and reabsorbed the visual sense was no longer dominant as a hidden ground. The electric, acoustic, and tactile sense was the hidden ground, because they are, the electric environment is a metaphor for and similar to the actions of the acoustic and tactile senses. We then had a new sense of interrelation with all matter, and we call it nature, Western man would call it nature, but all of reality. It had a transparency. For visual biased man, it was opaque. But for electric man, it's transparent again. Therefore, the need for ecology came back, a sense of interacting with all the senses and all the environments made by our senses, that are extensions of our senses, so the visual bias decreased. So what I'm saying about this is that it's sort of like a sociology of knowledge. We are looking at different cultures and why they say things about reality as opposed to other cultures, and the hidden ground is not just what anthropology studies, cultures per se, but the media they use, the forms of communication, is the broadest sort of hidden ground that determines a culture's bias. So we can talk about whether things are animate or inanimate only in terms of ratios between cultures of whether they think something is animate or inanimate, and why they tend to say animate, say something is alive and other things are not alive. You know what I mean?
It sounds like what you're doing there is you're equating animate and inanimate with conscious and unconscious, though. And is that a fair, can we equate them?
Animate and inanimate? Well, no. I meant that If certain preliteral cultures consider nature alive, and that's obvious from Native Americans and the culture,
right,
that comes through those pre-industrial, preliteral societies, and then you had a society that didn't believe that nature was alive.
Just a machine,
an impersonal machine. That machine metaphor, what they call the Newtonian universe, has collapsed and has become the Einsteinian world, or maybe there's going to be a new metaphor, the Tesla world or something. But it is not, the quantum science does not see the mechanical Newtonian model as adequate. And that's a cliche of the 20th century. We all have heard about this.
Right.
You see a new organicism. That organicism is unconsciously getting out of the control of the visual bias and getting back into a harmonious interaction of all the senses, which retrieves pre-literate society sensibility, which was not fragmented and isolated by the visual sense, and therefore had a sense of interaction with the environment in a more holistic, active and passive, not passive, active, interactive way. So we are retrieving the awareness of these preliterate cultures as a new value.
But, it's interesting. I understand what you're saying, about how the power of language. I mean, Terence McKenna talks about how language actually creates reality.
Right.
But that's a common
preliterate awareness. You know, the Eskimo has always said, "How can I know stone without the word stone?" For them, the word was the thing. And McKenna is retrieving that awareness, not aware that the new language, which is the electric environment, is making us see reality that way. So we have to look at the new language, the electric language, causing these effects.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than saying, oh, language is something that creates reality. Of course language creates reality. Man is a measure of man, in a sense.
But Bob, isn't it, I mean, language is, I mean, primarily for most people, auditory. I mean, it's not visual. Most people don't even read.
But what happened when it became visual? And then what happened when we became post-visual? That's what I'm talking about. Language changed, and the concepts change. Because whether it's acoustic or visual matters.
Uh-huh. And you see us returning to something that's going to involve more of the senses at once, and by actually taking one sense and blowing it out of proportion, distorts our perception of reality.
Yeah. And now here's the problem. The tactile sense is what we extended with television. And the nature of the tactile sense is that it is the sense that interrelates all the other senses and makes coherent consciousness. In other words, it takes input on the acoustic level, the visual, the kinetic, the proprioceptive, the smell, and the taste, and then interrelates them and makes you have coherent consciousness where everything's kind of integrated and you have a whole sensorium operating. All right? That's the tactile sense. It is the sense that interrelates things. It's almost like a hidden sense.
It means it's like the common denominator sense.
In the medieval period, they called it the sensus communis. But so it is like a switchboard. And then television is a switchboard.
Okay, and evolutionarily, it's probably the first sense to emerge.
That's right. Yeah. The beginning, the end are the same. So we see how we've made a metaphor of that through our technologies. We went to the acoustic first, in general with speech. Then we went with visual, with writing and print. And then we started to move into iconography, movies and photographs, which showed gesture, we could say, gesture and movement. Then television came along, which completed the metaphor of our senses, because it interrelates sight, sound, kinetic, smell. Many people who see, say, something of a certain vibrancy or smell will subconsciously or unconsciously smell it when they see it on television.
Right, right.
See a bright color that evokes a certain kind of strong smell. So TV includes all the senses. We don't have smell-o-vision yet, but that would be a particular offshoot and a fragmented extension of television.
Well, we've actually just, it was on CNN just yesterday, that somebody in London has developed a computer that has an olfactory sense.
All right, I'm going to get that. But television is the major matrix for, like, between the past. It's like the singularity they talk about. Jerry and I and another person did a whole talk on whether television was a singularity or not. You know the scientific term? It's like a
center of a black hole where the laws of physics break down.
Yeah, and some new thing is happening, and it takes a while to figure out how it is or whether it's even a question whether you can express what it is. So television is a singularity in a sense. We have now created an environment that mimes all our senses, and in other words, it's an extension of the tactile sense. Television is tactility extended because it's interrelating all the senses. So when we extend something, we create an environment that's tactile, then that affects all the acoustic cultures, all the visual cultures, all the kinetic cultures, and all the ESP cultures, say the Atlanteans or whoever had that kind of reality. Maybe Amazonian cultures do. The thing is that if tactility is altering all of us and all our historical baggages, then we have to understand that because we will try to retrieve acoustic models, which is what McKenna does. The psychic people try to retrieve ESP models. The scientists try to retrieve organic models. All these retrieved models are attempts to put back into their bias, their discipline, the hidden effects of tactility extended.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So we're into a situation which is very hard to express. And the best image of a tactile environment is a page of Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
This man figured out how to express the tactile interplay of all the senses in the sort of the opposite medium, the page.
Or Thomas Pynchon did a very good job at it, too, actually.
No, because he stays within, he talks in language. I mean, he talks in English.
Gravity's Rainbow?
Yeah. It's just written in English. Remember, Finnegan's Wake is written, in terms of verbal media, in over 65 languages. Mm. And so he's already got that bias down by showing the mishmash of languages, the Tower of Babel that the Electric Age brings in. And then he puts it on a flat mosaic, which is what, for the visual sense, if you're in a tactile environment, the visual sense is a flat mosaic. It's like Eskimo realities. If you read some of Edmund Carpenter's work, he describes the Eskimo way of seeing things, and it's very—it's a very good metaphor for the way people feel they live today. So the Eskimos have a very flat mosaic. It's just all white and snow, right?
Yeah.
So visually, it's very bland. And for a lot of people, over the last 15 years, they've begun to find the world, wherever you go in the world, it's generally homogeneous. All the airports are the same. We're beginning to get a bland, universal global village culture due to the global theater of television and satellites. So on a visual sense, it's becoming a flat mosaic. But we still have very rich, you can go anywhere in the world and hear all kinds of radio and different culture sound content, and it's quite a diverse, you know, variety. So we have lots of a rich acoustic level, which pre-literate societies have, and we have a lot of kinetic activity, moving around through movies or cars or airplanes or in aerobics and all that kind of stuff using our kinetic senses. And then there's the other senses that are being retrieved. So we have a very rich society, but if you look at it as on the visual sense level, it looks very bland, and the sameness and standardization appears to be showing up all over the place. This is what Nora Mailer used to complain about.
But that basically just holds things in place, is what you're saying, so that we can then have the freedom to be more multisensory, tactile, and such.
Yeah. What did you say was in place?
The things that are the same everywhere. This
visually,
this conformity that we see. You know, the modular structures that are built everywhere on the planet that are the same.
Sort of Americanization of the McDonald's metaphor.
Yeah, right. The Coca-Cola metaphor, or whatever.
Yeah, but that's only from one sense point of view. Your eye, in visual sense. Think of the rich. Think of the environment people live in every day. They listen to all kinds of radio stations and TV stations. They read different magazines, see different movies. Using the other senses, not just the visual, there's quite a variety.
So you see this as coming from primarily a tactile, multisensory experience in a tribal way, and that we've fallen into this historical process where we're...
Visualization.
Where we took the visual sense and we exaggerated it, or we focused on it.
Yes.
Now, do you see there as being a reason for this? Is this part of an overall plan? Is this so we can go back into the tactile with new dimension?
That's right. We go back with the individuation that visual space created. You see, there are no individuals in the way we in the West understand an individual personality or individual cultural figure. In pre-literate cultures, it was the group ruled, the mandate of acoustic space. It was like fascism. And they had certain services and disservices in pre-literate cultures. I mean, they had great group awareness, but there was no strong individual sense. So you can see how we've extended our senses in phases, and when we extended the visual sense, we then fragmented the individual out of the tribal group, started to develop individual acuity, which was the first archetype of that was the Greek culture, then the Romans, and then the European culture brought back the individual after sort of a more group-oriented medieval period where the visual media papyrus disappeared for a while. But when papyrus and paper came back, then it was spread with the printing press, the visual sense came back. So then you had this heightened individualistic culture. Now then, the individual culture outdid itself. It created technology by emphasizing the individual and the fragmentary style of knowledge done by science, which comes out of the visual space, and the way they analyzed and processed nature. It flipped into itself and created a whole new technology which retrieved acoustic tribal environment, which swamped the individual. And Hitler was the image of that, the way he took, you know, whole societies and put them in the ovens. The Holocaust. There was no respecting of the individual. It was just group conflict. All right? Tribalism was retrieved. Now, that is a problem for the individual heritage of the West, because they are no longer prominent as a ground, as a visual bias ground. But, luckily, the computer has brought back a bit of visual space, because you can now read on the computer. It's still got the tactile effect of the computer cathode tube.
Right.
There's still the visuality. So the visual sense has been brought back into balance. The individual, idealistically, and this is what your book, The Mavericks of the Mind, is, it wakes up individuals who say we have to have a new understanding of the individual in relation to the environment, not on an ego trip. That's the attraction of the Buddhist psychology, Oriental wisdom. And that is the service of the Oriental cultures. They emphasize the interaction of the individual and the group. The West emphasizes the individual. So we now have to, luckily, we're made visually biased to develop our individual skills Now we have to figure out how to relate our individual skills in relation to the new acoustic, kinetic, and especially tactile environment. And
but,
we have,
yeah, but let me just stop you just a second, Bob. What you're talking about happened primarily in the West.
Yes.
And we don't really see this in places like Japan. I mean, where there's certainly as much technological application as there has been here, and yet there's a very powerful group mind there and a group mentality.
Right. Now, here's the thing. If one was biased in towards, it said, in the end, I know where we're going to develop acoustic and tribal tactile technology, but I'm a visual man, and this is maybe what Joyce did, James Joyce, because I'm a visual man, and I value the visual sense, and I'm going to preserve all the different sensory cultures inside of a visual matrix, the book.
Yeah.
But let's say we took that as an idea. How do we preserve the Western sense of the individual? And then comes all these, and we're dedicated to it at the turn of the century. Then comes the telegraph. Well, the telegraph was already there, but let's say the telephone, the radio, the television, the computer, satellite. We think, my God, the visual sense hasn't got a chance against these new, more powerful technologies. I mean, a computer or the TV is way more powerful and in a shaping way compared to this puny printing press.
Right.
That was 200 years ago. So how would one preserve the individual, especially when I'm determined, and this is maybe what the Christian fundamentalists are expressing, they're dedicated to visual space, and we're going to convert those Chinese and those Indians and the Africans to the visual metaphor of Christ, all right, and
right.
The medium of Christ, the Bible.
Yeah.
So they can't win when you have oral cultures, the Chinese and the group mind, which was never industrialized, called the Third World in general, when their groupiness is enhanced by radio and television and computers. So we can't even begin. The white page bias fanatic cannot even begin to communicate to them because he's inside an environment where literacy doesn't have the attraction of the electric group technologies for cultures that are already groupy. Now, here's the paradox, though. That electric technology, because remember, tactility is acultural. Tactility is neither acoustic or visual. Therefore, it's something that the acoustic culture doesn't fully grasp, and the visual culture doesn't grasp. So when you have a tactile environment of the mixed corporate media, which is TV, computers, satellites, and radio, swamping any part of the world, whether you're third world or first world industrial, it is going to cause an identity crisis for that group. So the Chinese and the Indians are intensified by the group effect of the electric media on their group bias, so they become very paranoid and then jump to the West to preserve themselves. And that's why the Japanese and the Chinese are running into industrialism, which is a problem that the ecological summits and ecological conferences deal with. How do we get to third world not to use our Western technology, which we see as kind of obsolete now, but for some reason they want it? That's because under the tactile mosaic, the Chinese want to retrieve visual space as a novelty for them in defense against the paranoid effect of group technologies on a group bias culture. You see what I'm saying? So you know what the Chinese are doing? About 10 years ago, they decided to adopt the phonetic alphabet. And they are taking all their culture and translating into the phonetic alphabet. And the drama for us today is, will this totally alter them and make them aggressive and outward bound and violent like the West was in a visual biased way, at the same time the electric technologies are making them more integrated?
That
is a drama. China is a key expression of this drama of will visual space come back through them? And it may not. And so the irony of it is that we already have a communication ecology because television, if we recognize its tactile nature, is the global Esperanto that bypasses every culture's visual or acoustic bias, individualistic or group bias, and is altering us. And if we can recognize that, we then have a way of seeing what is making us upset, like you said at the beginning of your talk, that the satellite was doing to different cultures.
You know, I know William Irwin Thompson makes a distinction between what he calls sperm cultures and egg cultures.
Yes.
That Western cultures are like sperms, and an old culture like China is an egg culture, and that things really change on the planet when the egg cultures change, because the sperm are always moving around. And
that's the battle between the matriarchy and the patriarchy. You can think of patriarchy as left hemisphere and visual biased, and the matriarchy is right hemisphere and acoustic bias.
Okay, then are you familiar with the distinction between dominator societies and partnerships? Dominator being both matriarchies and patriarchies, and all achiarchies, where one group, one sex, one race rules over another.
Yeah, the chalice and the blade.
Right, and the idea where there's a partnership and there's a equality between people.
Yeah, now, William Irwin Thompson, I know him, and he did a very interesting talk on Ryan Eisler about her stuff, and he thought that she should have given him credit for talking about it before she did, years before, in his book Time, Falling Bodies Take Delight, and any earlier writings he did in the 70s. He talked about, that was the dialectic he used. Hmm. Ryan Eisler kind of retrieved it from his point of view, but he agrees that Ryan Eisler's book is a good book and is useful for people to read it. But I think there, the partnership, the dominator is visual space. That's obvious. That's isolating the visual sense and dominating the other senses. That's left hemisphere, and that's the West. What's the word? Participation?
Partnership.
Partnership society,
yes,
is pre-phonetic alphabet, pre-Western culture, goes back into, you know, pre-weaponry, and mm-hmm. pre-tribal, like the Amazonian cultures that Sting and various people talked about, or Miss mm-hmm. McKenna.
Mm-hmm.
They're partnership societies in a lot of ways. They're tribal. They're actually tactile. It's almost, if you take Ryan Eisler as a new idea, the partnership as opposed to one or the other, then partnership is recognizing the interactiveness of the tactile interval. And so it's a tactile bias concept. But the problem, like anybody who writes a book, they're offering the figure, the concept, without talking about the ground that we live in.
Mm-hmm. So you really see a major change then occurring in China as a result of them going from a more hieroglyphic almost alphabet to a phonetic alphabet.
Yeah, there'll be a major change. Now, the problem is it's almost a futile change. You see, this is the thing. The Japanese jump and are really into American culture
mm-hmm.
and the content, because it's a novelty to them. You have to realize that when the printing press came in, books were a novelty. Books were like televisions, new ugly media,
mm-hmm.
ugly new threats to the medieval status quo. And so for the Chinese, visual and individualistic space, and for the Japanese too, or for any third world cultures,
yeah.
being an individual, being the image of the all-American worker, which is almost the Bob Dobbs image that Ivan Stang talks about, the super salesman, right?
Yeah.
That kind of capitalistic image,
right.
That is a novelty to them. They are attracted to that image.
Mm-hmm.
When we as America have exhausted that image, are now getting affected by the corporate effects of TV and tactility and the tribal retrievals, so you have the white affluent parts of American society not interested in the individualistic pursuit of goals and more interested in togetherness or group behavior. And this started in the 60s with all kinds of weird group behaviors, or weird for Western society, that were retrieved. Everything from wife swapping to psychedelics to political agitation to dropouts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know Terrence McKenna talks about how what it was that that made partnership societies, the reason that they weren't dominators was not only because of group psychedelic sessions, but also because of group orgies.
Yes.
And as a result of that, they couldn't then trace the male lineage.
That's right. There's no private individual thing. And Thompson talks a lot about the myth of Isis and Osiris, because it was Seth, Isis's brother, who had the power. Because it was a matriarchy, the only male who had the power was the relative of the woman.
Mm-hmm.
The husband was a very a character off on the side and had no force in determining the structure of the society. But when writing came in, then it upset, and this is what Thompson's book, The Time Falling Bodies Take Delight, talks about, that the myth changes, and Isis is no longer happy with her relationship with Seth as her brother,
mm-hmm.
and Seth sees this new relationship developing between the husband, who's Osiris, and Isis,
yeah.
and Osiris starting to get new status, so Seth, representing the old establishment, kills him.
I see.
And that myth is the beginning of showing the shift to left hemisphere and visual space, the shift of the value of Osiris, of that, you know, of the sperm. Because before writing and before individualistic visual bias came in,
mm-hmm.
you had, as you just said, the group merger where everybody was everybody. And mm-hmm. there was no distinction, other than maybe towards the egg metaphor, which was the woman.
Right.
Who was more acoustic than the man.
Uh-huh.
So, now you brought that up for what reason? You said that egg cultures really change when they change.
Oh, I was just saying, what William Irwin Thompson had said, that when the things really change on the planet, when the egg cultures change, sperm cultures are always changing.
Yes.
And you know there's really a global shift when a culture like China changes.
That's right. So that, see, the woman is continuous, to use archetypes, and the man is discontinuous. The right hemisphere, tribal societies have a lot of change on the surface, but they're very conservative. They don't change on the basics.
Right.
Whereas
right.
left hemisphere and visual bias applied technological knowledge societies, we expect change. So we try to cover up by having a uniformity on the surface, and that was nationalism and patriotism and the Victorian image
mm-hmm.
of everybody conforming on the surface in social interaction. But underneath, they were creating new
yeah.
technologies that would really upset them.
Right.
The real hidden motive was to change. Whereas in tribal societies, there's lots of confusion and blurring on the surface, but underneath there's a very rigid hierarchy.
Just the opposite, yeah.
Right. And so then when visual technology, the West, based on visual space, needs change, comes into a very, say, iconic and static environment, the electric environment, which just stops us and puts us all into a discarnate state, then we have our goals of moving along industrially are usurped by the TV image. So we have nowhere to go. So we've returned to the tribal state of staying in one situation on the deepest level. And then the cultures that are tribal, that have a static, let's say, unchanging basic nature, why do they change? Why do the A culture change? And if they change, then something's really changing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Thompson means, that when you bring in tactile television, it alters, it makes the acoustic right hemisphere egg cultures need to change because their identity image is erased, since they had specialized in acoustic space,
right.
It's erased by the new space of tactility. So tactility threatens even the egg cultures, and that's why the egg cultures are changing today, and therefore we're in a new, what he calls, singularity. Thompson will use that word.
Yeah.
As even the, as he said, the women are changing or want to mm-hmm. change, or the tribal cultures like China are.
Mm-hmm. So do you see something in the sense like a global culture emerging, or do you think such a thing is really impossible?
A global culture
yeah.
agreed upon?
Well, I mean, in the sense that, you know, there's like an American culture. Is there going to be a some kind of global equivalent to that?
Okay, you could say that the 60s were at the pinnacle of ecological harmony, technologically speaking, because you had television, you had satellite, and computers.
Right.
But if you keep tactility going, and that was you can say mixed corporate media equals tactility, all right?
Yeah.
And the mixed corporate media are television, satellites, computers, and radios, and newspapers. All factors are in there.
Yeah.
But to sum it up, we'll just call it the TV image. When... I just lost my flow there. Okay, now, that is the hidden ground. We'll call that tactility. If you keep doing tactility, if you keep giving it as an environment, and therefore the society becomes biased in a tactile sense, then you've upset the sensory balance. See, this is what's interesting. We were balanced right in the 60s, where you had still literate people, and yet you had a new tactile ground. So for a short while, and that's probably why for many decades or centuries into the future, I can predict, just like people will take drugs, there will be this, you know, Arthurian myth about the 60s as a wonderful time.
What kind of myth was that?
King Arthur?
I didn't hear what you said. What was the word you used?
Arthurian.
Gotcha, yep.
King Arthur.
Yep.
That's like Camelot. That's
gotcha.
What he represented. That's why there's the power of the Kennedy image. He was right there when that balance was established between tactile, kinetic, and visual and acoustic.
Yeah.
But then as we moved into computers and more high-tech in the 70s, we kept the tactility. The balance became extreme because the balance, paradoxically, is not a balance. It's just an extension of the balancing factor, which is tactility. In other words, if the balance is all the senses in harmony, which is what happens when you talk. When you talk with somebody, all your senses are involved. Speech is actually not just acoustic, but it's a tactile environment. When you're having one-on-one speech with someone in person,
mm-hmm.
using all your senses, and you're having immediate simultaneous communication, including maybe even ESP or intuition.
Mm-hmm.
So then all technologies are fragments of speech or fragments of language.
Mm-hmm.
So you either went visual, kinetic, or tactile. So television as a machine is an extension of the tactile sense, of the balancing sense.
Mm-hmm.
But you've made it, it's not talking with somebody, there's a whole environment involved in it,
mm-hmm.
machine environment. So if you extend tactility and overuse it, you can look at Marshall's laws of media, what happens when tactile space is pushed to the extreme? It flips into being uptight or kinetic space. In other words, kinetic space comes back. And my general drift, as I've said through the last few years is that the idea that America won the Cold War, that the West won or capitalism won or something, whatever you want to call this thing that they claim they won, is really just the global retrieval and preference for kinetic space, which is the American archetype. America is movies, cars, and newspapers, let's say, and radio, a basic pre-television environment, the 20s and 30s. That kinetic space, and that's the main sensory characteristic of America, now being retrieved by all cultures in the world, and that's what Tim Leary thinks is the global village, the Americanization of the world, the preference for American values of individual entrepreneurship and consuming, using your bodies as an antidote to the extreme tactile wash and tactile mud bath that we're swimming in, which cannot be bought, sold, or stolen. And so if we have tactility going too long, that's why I recommend turning off the TV environment for a while, collectively.
Yeah.
If we keep doing it, you're going to have a global village based on American culture. Because kinetic space is all you got when visual space is puny, and even music is puny, compared to the mobility and kinetic reality of American media.
Right, but American culture, though, is basically, I mean, American culture is made up of all the other cultures. So in some sense, it is kind of like a global culture already.
That's right. That's where we come to the Akashic Records. Remember I said the movie medium is like Akashic Records. It contains all times and spaces. So America was the global culture. And Wyndham Lewis wrote a great book in 1948 called America and Cosmic Man. And he was speaking to the post-World War II European culture, which was still very snobbish toward America, and said, you Europeans don't realize that the future is being hatched in America. And basically, in McLuhan terms, and McLuhan learned a lot from Wyndham Lewis, that kinetic space, which is the American movie reality, can contain all cultures and will become the global village.
Yeah, it makes sense to me.
That global village is inside the tactile global theater, and it's only a collective preference by everybody. But at the same time, electric media, especially computers, allows every culture to decentralize and to prop up its own local culture, which we call tourism. You can go, and everybody will be propping up the historical baggage, which I call the mythic stage, of their particular culture, while they need to make money to interact with the kinetic culture archetype of America. All those two things inside the endless, confusing finneganese of the satellite environment. See what I mean? All cultures, even though we try to retrieve the American kinetic space and try to preserve our own cultural heritage, that leads to political correctness.
Right.
Every person and every tribe becomes a mythic stage, and you must appreciate their whole sense of time and history that they've developed in history and time, and their cultural baggage. That all has to be acknowledged.
Before they could plug into the global circuit.
Well, they are plugged in, and the plugging in of the global theater circuit requires them to prop up their own identity with great ferocity and seriousness, no joking about your political correctness, and at the same time consuming the kinetic media of America, all of it moving at the post-Clinton pace where Clinton can't handle even implementing the national health situation, because the factor is we're all discarded and we have disappeared. And that's the joke.
Where have we gone? Where have we disappeared to?
That's right. Well, you listen to my album and I try to explain it.
Yes, I have actually.
So you're laughing, you got the joke. This is a big joke, and this is where mixed corporate media is a satire on us. We can satirize ourselves through speech, but all the technologies are like our speech. We now have made this grand speech through various fragments of technologies and machines.
Yeah.
Now implode and make, and this is where in my book, Fatted Communion with Bob Dobbs, quotes Croker, Baudrillard and the structuralists and post-structuralists and semioticians try to describe this environment as signs, and they say we're in a situation where the signs have no reference point, no reference, and no referent. So therefore, the very signs of our society are satirizing us. They are manipian tactility. They cannot be labeled. They cannot be pinned down, and that's the tactile sense. So the mixed corporate media today are doing a satire on us.
I'm not sure I fully understand that.
Think of it this way.
Yeah.
The implosion of all the media into the situation where the word makes the market. The White House makes the market. What the White House says affects everybody in the world and affects the stock market.
Right.
I mean, if you know, like just a little change, like if Whitewater looks like it might gain momentum, then the stock market goes down. The gold price of gold goes up. All media start changing. And this, like, this thermostat based on the White House, which is American kinetic space.
Right.
Not Clinton. It's the cultural archetype of too much tactility. Therefore, we retrieve a need for kinetic space.
Gotcha. Yeah.
This kinetic space looks at, as we focus on kinetic space, we are not in kinetic space. We are in a tactile environment. So as we try to prop up any solution, any technological band-aid for the problems we have today in all the different cultures, we never can put our finger on it because that environment is changing, and in a changeless and paradoxically changing state called Manipian tactility, and that's moving money at the speed of light nowhere. They're making millions and trillions of dollars every day, but what is it? It's a bunch of electronic signals. At the same time, what are they trying to buy? You can't buy the electric environment. I have immense wealth just by turning on my TV that no one person can buy. I can't buy a television station and demand NBC to make all these programs for me.
Well, but, I mean, some information is more valuable than others, though, and some information is more available than others.
Well, that is the problem for the discarnate super angel, which we all are, is selecting, filtering, and editing information. What are you going to attach to? What are you going to put values in?
So, I mean, information becomes the commodity of the future, basically.
And think of information not just as a mathematical formula, but the technology that it creates. And that technology alters us, like the whole problem about high-definition TV. What's that going to do to society? Who's going to get it? And this kind of thing. Meanwhile, Russia still puts up the most satellites in around the planet than any culture. And yet we have an image that Russia is a basket case.
Yeah.
How come they can keep putting up the most satellites? And why are they doing that?
Well, I actually don't even know. I mean, are they efficient? What kind of satellites are they?
They're satellites that everybody wants to buy into because...
They're telecommunication satellites?
Yes, yes. They're satellites. There's probably all kinds of different kinds of satellites. They, numerically, put up the most satellites of any culture in the world. But anyways, I don't think I got the tactile manipulation tactility expressed. I just want to say... what was it? Just say something to get us back on track there about what we were talking about. That you didn't get how it's a satire on us.
Oh yeah, you were explaining how the corporate media, everything that the corporate media does, is a satire of us.
Oh yeah, we're talking about wealth and the fact that $1 trillion and there's money as a hologram.
Right.
What does it measure? And this transaction, which Baudrillard calls the ecstasy of communication, where all the media just interact and keep moving. That's kinetic space. Look at busy. Just keep doing whatever you do or drop what you're doing and do something else, but keep moving. All the time, you are in touch everywhere. You're in touch with everything on the planet electrically. In this telephone, we could have a conference call with 5,000 people all listening. And then if that was broadcast on radio stations, you got another millions of people listening.
Right.
Where are we? We're all in a little magnetic, electromagnetic space that we can't see, but we can feel. And we're interacting. That little node, the whole world is interacting on, and you can call it a computer terminal, you can call it a television screen, but that node has no visual boundaries. You can't localize it, but we're all inside that. And that space we're inside of, it's like quantum. You know, the size is smaller than electron and bigger than the sun.
Mm-hmm.
It includes all dimensions. That thing is what we're every day living in, and subconsciously, collectively, we want to fill up that interval.
Well, we're perfecting it, in a sense. I mean,
we're perfecting the content of it.
Right.
We can't do anything to it. We're trying to sort of, since we're all inside of it and we've got 5 billion people inside of it, we now say, well, let's bring in digital technology and virtual reality where we'll be able to target each person's fantasy and sort of split up this resonating interval to that person's needs.
I see. Huh.
And that's talked about in the same Mondo 2000 that has Hans Moravec in it. There's a guy talking about the virtual reality in the future targeting your personal fantasies. So that, you know, you, or maybe Jerry Fialko there, they will sell him videos of Frank Zappa and the whole collection of Frank Zappa to him, and just to him, and it'll come into his little virtuality goggles.
Right. So let's carry this whole thing far into the future. And where is this all going? Are we journeying into some place where basically were we living in our imaginations, in a sense, where there's going to be no longer a distinction between inside and outside? Is that where we're moving towards, do you believe?
All those things that you just said, we've been living in for, let's say, since 1957 or the 60s. creation technologically ended in the 60s, because all we've been doing since in the 70s and 80s is fine-tuning, putting back into what's called high-tech, but is actually left-hemisphere visualization or individuation of every potential that was latent in the 60s. Anything that can happen in the future can be thought of, and you can experience maybe in a movie or in a book or in a TV show. And so all potential futures, Marshall used to say, are already happening. All you have to do is think about them, and then you see, yes, we've already got that. In other words, nothing could go past the implosion of society, of human beings, than what happened in the 60s when we imploded into this discarnate resonating interval, which may be what Dave Worster is talking about, who sometimes on my show, when he says the original separateness, Ra'i, returned to the plane of essence. All of being is united now. And so we can now just do... This is where imagination comes in as a retrieval. We can imagine any kind of scenario, and that's like a hologram or virtual reality, and we will actualize it now through a personal video subscription, or maybe a whole society, part of Canada, will adopt a certain movie set kind of environment and put on that situation for a while.
Obviously... Maybe not obviously. I mean, there are physical limitations in terms of what we can do, and within the imagination, there's no limitation.
Yeah, well, the imagination's always been there, so therefore that's part of the private citizen consciousness. So you have to you can look at how different technologies altered a society's interpretation of what the imagination is. And since we're all resonating now in a tactile sphere, part of people's problems is how do we even imagine today? Since we have so much images going. Evoking all periods of history, just think of all the movies, then this is part of the passivity that people think, in the year 2525, we'll have no arms and legs and all that stuff. That already happened by the 60s, because you have so much imagery, sound and visual and kinetic to swim around in,
yeah.
That you either get fed up and go into private psychedelic use or into Gnostic denial of the word and try to meditate yourself and get out of your body. Or you become a super consumer and make lots of money and fly all over the world and consider the world a museum.
Right.
All these problems of what to do when we have so much wealth have already been with us. And society doesn't know how to define a new economic order, because that's wealth, but we already have so much wealth that the old money wealth doesn't mean anything. So then you have the grievance of people, the working middle class, and you have to look today at every class as a transitory thing. In other words, there are people moving from the poor class to the middle class to the upper class. They're moving through. So you can't categorize anybody as poor or middle class or wealthy, because many people move through them or interact with people from all different classes.
Yeah.
So therefore, the archetype of the middle class hangs around as a separate mythic stage itself and gets mad at the archetype of the welfare. All right?
Wait, the archetype gets mad at the archetype?
Yes. This is the global language is going on, which I write about in my liner notes.
Mm-hmm.
The archetype of the middle class is screaming at the archetype of the welfare, because it resents the fact that it is working and has to go out and work in an office and be away from all the radio and TV entertainment, and the welfare person can stay home and swim around in the software well. Where the commuter, the middle class guy, is in his hardware vehicle, stuck in the pollution and all the problems of daily work. Now, these people... And we're doing this more and more. This is what they mean by joblessness. Many people are poor and middle class and rich, different phases of their life.
Right, and this is almost unheard of, in prior generations.
That's right, and that's why Marxist critique failed. Any kind of critique based on class, early LaRouche used to talk about class critique and making the working class conscious of itself. The working class was a transitory amoeba, which contained many people that were in it for a while, then dropped out or moved on. So just to argue or to interpret society in terms of class struggle is so limited now, because all these class struggles are archetypal and contain impostures.
In America?
In the whole world.
Well, I mean, the caste system in India hasn't changed. I mean, in England it hasn't changed. I mean, the caste system is still very much in place, though. I don't know that it really does change.
Those are particular cultures. Yeah, you can say that the Industrial Revolution happened mostly in America. So the class structure happened in America in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And most of all, and therefore, it is the most obsolete by this new iconic absolutism of the tactile image. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I would say on a certain level, the class struggle is an American phenomenon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Industrial phenomenon. I mean, there was class struggle in the European countries, but you're right, there was a heavy medieval baggage. Mm-hmm. And that's why Wyndham Lewis said, American Cosmic Man, in that book, he said the European cannot understand the wide open spaces of the new tactile kinetic world we live in, because they live in little cities, and the feudal, the oligarchy, the aristocratic oligarchy still had control, and therefore the problem with being a Canadian is that he's stuck with, he could have had American technology, British politics, and French culture. And what mm-hmm. that was, French politics, British technology, and American culture. Ideally, we would have had American culture, British American technology, British politics, and French culture.
Right.
All right. Now, this mixture of that perfection, and I'm only using this as a temporary model. I mean, you could quibble whether French culture is perfect, but you think of the Parisian and this, the symbolists of the 19th century Baudelaire, they still have a strong effect for people.
Do it in a minute, Bob.
So in this, the mixture of cultures
yeah.
is in a total confusion as expressed on the page of Finnegan's Wake, because none of the archetypes have any staying power anymore, whether American, industrial, working class, or Amazonian.
They're dissolving. The dissolving archetypes.
Everything's disappeared.
All right. My name is Jerry Fialka for Contemporary Communications Conference. We would like to thank David J. Brown, who co-authored the book Mavericks of the Mind, and Bob Dobbs, who wrote the book Phatic Communication with Bob Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. For a list of the books mentioned in this dialogue and for more information on Contemporary Communications Conference, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to 2427½ Glendon, Glyndon Avenue, Venice, California, 90291. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, David. That was excellent.